Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Some say of baseball that it's won by managers with smarts, and some say it's the players with the hungriest of hearts. Still others claim it's fan support that's winning's crucial reason. But how much of the deal goes down in baseball's long off season? That's a question I'll put now to our baseball analyst, Tim Kirkchian of ESPN and ESPN.com. He joins me from his home. Tim, you ready for some good hot stove league talk?
Absolutely, Bill.
The Yankees signed highly regarded Japanese hitter Hideki Matsui, known in some quarters as Godzilla, as well as the much sought after Cuban star Jose Contreras. No real news there, right? The rich get richer.
Well, in the Yankees' case, it's always this way, and it will continue to be this way. And you Red Sox fans, including you, Bill, had better get used to that. It's only going to get worse from here. George Steinbrenner said, we're cutting back this year, and instead he goes out and gets the premier Japanese slugger on the market. He goes out and gets the best pitcher in Cuba, and he's got now 8 starting pitchers, Bill. The Red Sox have 3. Some teams have 1. He's got 8. And he still says, we're going to cut payroll, yet his payroll is going to be at least $175 million next year.
George Steinbrenner also said of those signings, quote, these guys told me I want to be a Yankee. It's global and it's good for baseball. I wonder if maybe the commissioner would give him an argument there.
And the other 29 teams also. Of course everybody wants to play for the Yankees. Who wouldn't? They pay the most money. They play in a great ballpark in one of the great baseball towns in America. And they always win. They at least always get to the playoffs. So it's no-brainer. If I were from another country and I had my chance to play anywhere, I would play for the Yankees also. And until the rules are changed dramatically, which, of course, they're not going to be for at least the next 4 to 5 years, the Yankees are going to continue to grab all the players that they need. The only danger, of course, is that they have to pay a severe luxury tax for signing all these guys. But I've thought all along, they'll pay the luxury tax if they think they can win the World Series.
Larry Lucchino, now a co-owner of the Red Sox, has referred to Mr. Steinbrenner's realm as the evil empire. Is this just sour grapes?
I think so, and you got to understand, Bill, Larry is the most competitive guy on the face of the earth, okay? He hates to lose. He's a Washington lawyer. He wins at everything he ever tries, and now he looks at the New York Yankees, and he acknowledges basically right away, I can't beat these guys. My payroll is going to be over $100 million, and I'm still going to be $50, $60 million underneath where the Yankees are. So I think that was said out of frustration. I think he probably regrets saying it, because all that will do is anger George Steinbrenner so much that he'll go out and sign somebody else.
All right, elsewhere, Jim Thome, late of the Indians, is a Philly now. Jeff Kent of the We Almost Made It Giants is an Astro. Tom Glavin, formerly of the always pitching deep Atlanta Braves, is a Met. Which of these three will make the greatest difference for his new club?
I think I'll take Thome, although all three of them are going to do wonders for their club. Thome gives the Phillies not only a power-hitting first baseman that they desperately needed, but he brings some credibility back to the franchise. This team really had not signed a big-time free agent since Pete Rose 20 years ago. So for them to finally come out and do something like this is a huge boost for the Phillies, and to follow it up with a couple of other free agents and another trade, the Phillies are back in the race in the National League East. That's very, very important. Tom Glavin, however, is equally important to the Mets, who, A, are trying to compete in a very difficult division and also are trying to compete with the Yankees for the back pages in New York, and he gives them credibility at a time where they've never needed it more. Jeff Kent won't help the Astros as much as those guys, but he does give them another big-time bat in the middle of their order.
Is there another especially great roster change that may change everything once the games begin again in the spring?
I don't see it, Bill. I don't see one team out there that has made a move that you say, uh-oh, there they go. They're going to go from second to first for sure, or they're going to jump from the bottom to the top for sure. But the greatest part about baseball, Bill, is that somebody is going to jump from the bottom to the top. And we're going to get to spring training, and we're all going to take our guess as to which team that's going to be. And there's a good chance I'm going to be wrong about that team. But that's the beauty of it. And we're still not done negotiating with players, Bill. There's still another 100 free agents out there waiting to find a team.
Tim, among the players who've rejected arbitration offered by their current employers are Chuck Finley, Ricky Bitalico, Ron Coomer, and Keith Lockhart. According to the arcane rules of baseball, this means these guys can't re-sign with their current employers until well after the 03 season has begun. Have any of them badly misjudged the lay of the free agent land?
Well, I can't imagine how they could have misjudged it, given the way it was last season and the way it has worked so far this year. This is a completely different market, Bill. Yes, some guys still get enormous amounts of money, including Jim Thome. However, the middle-of-the-line guy, the guy who's used to making $2, $3, $4, $6 million a year, he's not getting that money for this year. 46 players were non-tendered on December the 20th, meaning they weren't offered contracts. Their team still want them back for the most part. They just want them back at a lower salary. And to reject arbitration at this point means I'm going to go ahead and get a better job from somebody else, and I'm just not sure there are better jobs out there.
We ought to talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame, Tim. I would assume you have no argument with the ascension of Messrs. Murray and Carter.
No, I voted for Eddie Murray. If he had not gotten in on the first ballot, I would have been embarrassed to be a member of the Baseball Writers Association because his numbers are so overwhelming when you really study them. There was no doubt about it. Gary Carter, I voted for every year that he's been eligible. I thought he was a first ballot Hall of Famer. He got in on his sixth try. When you look at what you're looking for a catcher, durability, defense, power, leadership, he's got them all. And he had them all for over 12 to 13 years, which is a very long time for a catcher to catch as many games as he did. Both those guys were no-brainer Hall of Famers for me.
Tim Kirkjian serves as baseball guy for ESPN and ESPN.com, and from time to time for Only a Game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
NBA basketball came to Memphis last year via Vancouver. The Grizzlies, apparently uninspired by the move, again missed the playoffs and then began this season by losing 8 straight games. In November, head coach Sidney Lowe was fired and replaced by 69-year-old NBA veteran Hubie Brown. Since then, the team has played 500 basketball, and the Grizzlies' record currently stands at 11-24. The team's improvement has created a shift in expectations, as Hal Humphreys reports.
Friday afternoons in Morris Park, at the intersection of Manassas and Poplar, Memphis locals gather inside of the Grizzlies' temporary home, the Pyramid, for a little open-court, 5-on-5 shirts and skins. Carl Staples handles the ball for the skins today. He's a migrant Chicago Bulls fan, but admits he supports the Grizzlies. Staples says that Memphis is unique among NBA towns.
People might not move the same, look the same, and all that, or act the same, but they got to understand, everybody in this city know basketball. That's been our main heart, basketball.
Carl Staples chafes when sportscasters say Memphis is not a good NBA town. Stephen Acosta, point guard for the Shirts, agrees.
They're still a young team. And they're still coming to Memphis. They don't know. Now with Hubie Brown, he's an old coach from the old school. He's teaching them some stuff that they're coming back. And matter of fact, they're playing ball together now.
During a late December game against the Milwaukee Bucks, Grizzlies' playoff fever was evident, despite their 7-20 record.
Maybe the playoffs next year.
If not this year, for sure next year we'll be in the playoffs, no doubt.
2 years from now, we can make the playoffs.
I think it's a potentially a playoff team.
30-year veteran head coach Hubie Brown was the 1978 NBA Coach of the Year. He inherited a 0-8 record after former head coach Sidney Lowe was fired in November. Brown's challenge is to improve the team while giving minutes to inexperienced players.
See, what you have here are a lot of talented kids with potential. Unfortunately, when we keep saying potential, we know that you have a long way to go.
Brown enjoyed success in Atlanta and New York, but he says coaching the Grizzlies may be his toughest challenge yet.
So in our 10-man rotation that we play every night, We have three rookies, and we have three guys who are first-year players who've been in the league a year, and then 2 second-year guys. So there's a lot of youth here.
Brown turned down 9 coaching jobs during his 16-year stint as a broadcaster. He agreed to coach the Grizzlies in part because of his personal relationship with general manager and NBA legend Jerry West. But Coach Brown says he's not sure yet whether his boss's goal for the team is realistic.
Jerry wants to have a team that is definitely playoff competing by the time this new building opens. So it's demanding, maybe unrealistic expectations.
The expectations for the franchise had been low, and I wanted to come in with a positive attitude and raise those.
Shane Battier came to Memphis from Duke University via the 2001 NBA draft. Battier carried his college team to a record-setting 142 victories during his 4 years. For Battier, who identifies himself as the winningest basketball player in NCAA history, playing in Memphis hasn't been easy.
It's been difficult, but it's been a different type of challenge for me. And here in my second year in Memphis, I think we're going to set a franchise record for wins this year. But the franchise record for wins is 23. And that's not a lot in the NBA. That's not a lot.
During the Grizzlies' 95-84 victory over the Bucks last month, 6-year-old Justin Johnson and his buddy C.J. Taylor discussed the Grizzlies' postseason chances.
My name's Justin Johnson, but I like the Grizzlies, even though sometimes they suck.
You think they're going to go to the playoffs anytime soon?
No, they're going to go to the playoffs next year. Because I prayed to them.
For Only a Game, I'm Hal Humphreys in Memphis.
You think they're going to have a chance to go to the playoffs?
Nope.
You don't think they're going to play in the playoffs?
They ain't going to play in the playoffs because they suck. You don't want them.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Absent state laws to limit the speed of snowmobiles, the town of Fort Kent, Maine, has instituted local speed limits on snowmobilers rocketing through that humble burg. Posted limits range from 15 to 45 miles an hour on the trails in and around Fort Kent, depending on the concentration of people, or perhaps whether there's a moose crossing in the vicinity. To demonstrate the seriousness of the new laws, the constabulary of Fort Kent began turning radar guns on snowmobilers 3 weeks ago, and according to Police Chief Kenneth Michaud, several speeders have already been summoned to court to pay $50 fines.
Life is a sleigh ride heaven. Ooh, snow is king in Uberland. Yeah.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For the latest sports headlines, go to WBUR.org and click on News, then Sports. We're funded by UR listeners and by Irving House at Harvard, a 44-room guest house near Harvard Square. Irving House since 1945, friendly accommodations in the heart of Cambridge. And Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for more than 14 years. Details at SOPHOS.com. The weather forecast, mostly sunny this morning, then becoming partly sunny this afternoon. Brisk, cold, highs near 30. Tonight, clear skies, lows around 20 degrees. And tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs in the mid-30s. In Boston now, it's 22 degrees and 23 in Hyannis. It's 720. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, shed the pounds and your inhibitions. But first, sailing has been described as the fine art of slowly going nowhere at great expense. For the two teams battling on the Hauraki Gulf to determine which will take on New Zealand in next month's America's Cup, sailing might be better described as the fine art of quickly going nowhere at astronomical expense. Joining us now on the line from Auckland, where he's covering the Louis Vuitton Cup, is Stuart Stroily, senior editor of Sailing World magazine. Stuart, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
The Louis Vuitton Cup pits San Francisco-based Oracle against the Swiss sailing team, Alinghi, a team which, oddly enough, includes New Zealanders, the same guys that helped the Kiwis win the America's Cup the last two times around. Given that fact, is it fair to call the Swiss team the obvious favorite?
Yes, there's no question about that. They've been one of the fastest teams throughout this competition. They've steadily improved at every round. And they beat Oracle 4-0 the last time that these two teams met. So there's no reason why you wouldn't call them a favorite.
Is experience the only advantage that Alinghi has on its side?
Well, it's important to remember that Oracle's not exactly short of experience either. Chris Dixon, their sailing master, so to speak, is on his fourth America's Cup campaign. And Ian Burns, the navigator, is a talented New Zealand sailor. But that said, no one has shown that they can win on the Hauraki Gulf, which is a very difficult body of water to sail on, like Russell Coutts and his key lieutenants, which are Brad Butterworth, Simon Daubney, and Warwick Fleury. Those four guys have sailed together for over a decade, and the communication between them borders on extrasensory. They really can anticipate each other's moves. That really makes a big difference when you're out there and every race is decided by just a few seconds. Plus, they also have a lot of momentum, and in match racing, momentum is really important. And, they haven't lost a race in quite a while and have had a lot of time to rest and get their boats ramped up for this event.
This is not the first time that Oracle billionaire Larry Ellison has tried to buy his way into the record books. What does his team need to do to get there?
They've had to make some key changes to the boat. They lost, last time they faced Alinghi, they lost the races by an average of 50 seconds. And so they need to make their boat faster. They need to make up that difference, and then they need to improve, because Alinghi certainly hasn't been standing still. Their boat's going to be faster coming into this round. They also need to start well. Russell Coutts, the Alinghi skipper, is probably the best sailor in the world, and the start box is his domain. No one is better than he is there. He takes control early, and he rarely lets go if he gains an advantage. They need to get an early win. Again, I spoke of momentum earlier, and they need to split the first two races. They cannot afford to go down 2-0 in this series, because history has shown that there aren't too many come-from-behind victories in the America's Cup. And in this America's Cup, with one exception, virtually all of the best-of-seven series have gone 4-0 or 4-1. So unless they get an early win, it's probably going to be a quick exit for Oracle.
Now, I gather that New Zealanders have been making it known they're none too pleased with Russell Coutts and his teammates. There have been signs proclaiming the word loyal cropping up around Auckland. This week it was reported that members of Alinghi received letters threatening the safety of their children from so-called patriotic activists. Crew members have changed sides before. This is nothing new. Why are New Zealanders so upset about the composition of the Swiss team?
It is interesting, because in the past, New Zealanders have maintained a connection to, New Zealanders who have gone. But this one just seems different. People see these guys as coming to steal something that is ours. They see it as traitorous. This event pumps in, estimates are of over $250 million American into the country's economy. So, that's a lot of money that's going to go somewhere else if they do lose.
This may be an incredibly uninformed question, but I can't resist. Switzerland is landlocked. Where does the cup go if the Swiss win, and where do they hold the next America's Cup?
That's a good question, and certainly one that everyone's been asking. I think if you ask the Alinghi team now, they will defer until they actually get into the America's Cup before they answer it. The educated guess is they're going to do it in the south of France, where Alinghi did a lot of its training. Certainly Lake Geneva is big enough to do some sailing on, but the winds are very fickle, the winter is long, and it wouldn't be a great place to sail the event. The south of France is much more consistent. Whether that lies within the original intention of the rule is certainly questionable, but right now it seems if they win, it's going to be held somewhere in Europe, but where it is, who knows, it could be up for sale for all we know.
Stuart, I understand that until this week, Team New Zealand had been practicing to meet its challenger under some very strange conditions. The Kiwis launched their boat at night. They kept a fabric skirt wrapped around the hull of the boat to protect, I gather, an ultra-secret hull design. The boat's hull was finally revealed at a ceremony earlier this week. Is it really revolutionary enough to justify all the fuss?
Well, it certainly is a strong departure from the norm. I hesitate to call it revolutionary, because this is the first and probably the last time you're ever going to see it in America's Cup competition. Most of the experts down here believe that if the next cup is contested with this same class rule, that they will make some sort of arrangement to prevent this sort of thing from happening in the future.
What exactly is the difference? What is the innovation?
Well, essentially, they have added a lot of extra volume to the stern of the boat and increased their waterline. In sailing, waterline is probably the prime indicator of boat speed. The longer the waterline, the faster the boat is. So because of that, the waterline is a key factor in any measurement rule. What they've done is they've been able to increase their waterline, increase the amount of volume in the stern without getting hit with any penalties from the rating rule. You know, whether or not it works, you know, it's still up for debate. Certainly some people say it's going to be a game breaker, but, you know, some people look at it and wonder why they've gone through all the fuss.
Is the general consensus that the modified design will be sufficient, that will carry the Kiwis to victory, or do they have to think about other things in order to ensure that result?
You know, there's a number of trade-offs to this particular design. It has a lot of extra drag because of the gap and the extra wetted surface. It's also a little bit heavier, and that weight is weight you can't have in the bottom of the boat, keeping it upright against the heavy air. Plus, you know, as I said before, Russell Coutts is the best sailor in the world in my mind. There's no one who is better at this game in particular. And no matter how fast their boat is, Russell Coutts has shown an ability to win in all conditions. And I would not bet against him going into this final.
Stuart Stroily is the senior editor of Sailing World magazine. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
On a recent winter afternoon in a small glass-walled room at a downtown Boston health club called Crush, half a dozen people are simultaneously pedaling stationary bicycles and singing their brains out. Sedentary and partial to quiet rather than raucous places, I couldn't help but wonder why.
Well, the attraction is that it gets you exercising and the karaoke kind of motivates you. It gets your mind off of the actual physical activity and gets you thinking about what you're saying, what you're singing, instead of actually what you're doing.
So the idea is you don't feel the pain as much if you're
exactly.
Bellowing out song
right. Even if you can't sing good, it still helps.
That's Jill Quattrelli. She'd been practicing cycle karaoke for about a month when we spoke, and she's right when she says a good voice or even the ability to carry a tune is no prerequisite for this class. But when I suggested that this particular gimmick variation on the quest for tight abs and toned quads might not significantly differ from pedaling a bike or running on a treadmill or sweating through a standard aerobics class with a manic instructor, she gently corrected me.
You kind of tune everybody out and focus on yourself. And the spinning's great because the lights are dim, the disco ball's on, you kind of can close your eyes and just be on your own, you know. I mean, a lot of times when you're in a aerobic class or if you're on your own on a treadmill, you don't really have anybody to keep you going, to motivate you. I mean, in an aerobic class, it's good, but everybody's watching you and everybody's looking at your steps, and if you don't do it right, it's really noticeable. As opposed to the spinning, you're kind of just, you're on your own.
Well, yeah, on your own, with a group of other sweating, straining spinners all shouting out the same techno pop. Actually, that's probably not entirely fair. It's not always technopop.
You know, there again, some of the people don't like the music that you select, that's selected on the screen, so I kind of bring tapes as well that, you know, like Barry White.
That's Kevin Barbosa, who leads some of the cycle karaoke classes at Crush.
People love Barry White. So you put Barry White on, they know all the words.
Slow-moving targets notwithstanding, perhaps these days fun should not be made of any exercise scheme. We are, according to an October survey published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, a nation of lard butts. The survey maintains that fully one-third of American adults are obese. The times would seem to call for healthier eating habits and more exercise, and perhaps no appeal along that line should be ignored. Whether it's the Christian aerobics classes available across the country under the auspices of bodyandsoul.org, where scripture study and prayer punctuate the elements of the workout, or something a little more secular. If it takes gimmicks to induce us to exercise, who's to say nay to gimmicks?
All right.
not C.J. Jamawis, for one. He's the instructor for another class currently popular at Crush. It's called Cardio Striptease.
Initially, it's like people come in with preconceived notions about, oh my God, what do I have to take off? What do I keep on? And stuff like that. And it's like a lot of inhibitions because people are just, you know, maybe they're not comfortable with their bodies yet or stuff like that. And the idea behind this class is being comfortable with whatever shape or size that you are. And so it's like initially like filling out the other students in the class. And then after a while, after doing warm-ups and then getting a little hot and everything, it gets a little more comfortable. And people tend to like, yeah, I'm going to take this off now.
Before this goes any further, so to speak, understand that nobody's taking it all off. The cardio striptease routine is more dance class than floor show, and as C.J. Jamawis acknowledges much more often than the class is prurient, it's just funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you have to be able to laugh, like, at, like, you know, I'm always laughing at myself putting it together, and I was thinking, well, how's the class going to react? And when everyone starts laughing about it, it kind of eases the tension when people kind of laugh about it. But then you see people laughing as they're doing it, but some people, you know, they start off class and they're all inhibited, and then as soon as they're pumping on the floor, they're, like, loving it. You know, I see a couple girls already tonight that were just in that way.
Whether one of those girls was Magalie DeSense, a first-time participant in cardio striptease in the class only a game attended, is perhaps open to interpretation, but it was evident that she was glad she'd come to class.
It's great for your limbs, you know, it's a good stretching class, and I think you could also learn some interesting moves.
Interesting moves, indeed. I asked Magalie DeSense, who actually left the class shortly before it ended, whether she could imagine the trend in new variations of aerobic exercise becoming any more outrageous.
No, probably not. Judging by some of those moves, I think some of these women are headed to, you know, the combat zone or something. But, you know, no, I don't think so.
It's doubtful that any of these exercises are headed for strip clubs. It's also unlikely that that's where they've been, although instructor C.J. Jamawis says he can understand how somebody watching his students work out might leap or slide or bump to the wrong conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Like, some people are like, oh, she's bending. Like, oh, she must have some background in it, or, oh, she must dance, or, you know, oh, she must be doing this at home, or whatever it may be, yeah. But, yeah, some people, you know, as soon as those inhibitions come down, they kind of let themselves go, and they just go into it really well.
The advantage of getting into it, whether it is cardio striptease, karaoke spinning, or one of the various other aerobic opportunities that was cutting edge just a week or a month or a year ago, is obvious. Even just walking briskly around the block a few times a week without benefit of a gym membership increases the likelihood that you'll stay outside or climb out of that third of the adult population that qualifies as obese. All the goofiness notwithstanding, that's a healthy resolution for any new year. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. University of Washington guard Kayla Burt decided to spend New Year's Eve with five of her teammates. They'd watch movies, eat not too much pizza, and stay up not too late, since they'd be expected at practice at 8:30 New Year's morning. At some point during the not-too-festive evening, Burt, who is 20 and halfway through her sophomore year, complained that she felt lightheaded. Then she collapsed. Over the next terrifying minutes, five of Burt's teammates worked to keep her alive. Juliana Mendiola and her sister Giaconda pumped Burt's chest and administered CPR. Later, Juliana said, "We didn't really know what we were doing. We were just doing what we remembered from TV shows." Another teammate, Erica Shelley, stayed on the phone relaying instructions from the folks at the other end of the 911 call. Another player rushed outside to direct paramedics to Burt, saving critical seconds. The happy ending to this remarkable story of a player and her teammates is that Kayla Burt, diagnosed with an inherited heart irregularity of which she was unaware, is fine. Her condition has been stabilized by a tiny defibrillator, which doctors implanted on Monday. Her teammates remained in the intensive care unit with her until she was out of danger and wouldn't agree to leave town for last weekend's two games until they were assured that Burt was safe and would be well enough to listen to those games on the radio. Washington lost the first one by almost 30 points to UCLA, but rallied the following night to beat Southern California in overtime on a bucket by Juliana Mendiola. At a press conference with her teammates a couple of days later, Kayla Burt said, "I am as lucky as anyone has ever been lucky. They're my sisters for life." The erstwhile shooting guard has been told that her basketball career is over, but she will continue to travel with the team, and Washington coach June Doherty has assured Kayla Burt that her scholarship will be renewed. In a couple of months, in the small print, you'll be able to see how the University of Washington Huskies did this season. Whatever the numbers are, they'll be superfluous as far as Kayla Burt is concerned. Juliana and Giaconda Mendiola, Erica Shelley, Lori Payne, these young women are champions. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Frugal Fannies, featuring current name brand and designer fashions for women, now featuring Fannies' new home and gift department, open Thursday through Sunday only, 888-FRUGALS. Good morning, I'm Bob C., and in sports headlines, the Dallas Mavericks easily handled the Celtics last night, cruising to a 103-78 victory in Texas. Paul Pierce had 20 points to lead Boston, which lost for the sixth time in eight games. Dirk Nowitzki led the Mavericks with 28 points. The Celtics head to San Antonio to play the Spurs tomorrow night. Meanwhile, the Bruins' losing streak now stands at 5 after a 4-2 loss at Buffalo. The Bruins took a 1-0 lead when Brian Ralston scored his 15th goal in the first, but the Sabres battled back. Boston's last victory was a 1-0 win over Atlanta December 28th. Boston will host Toronto tonight. Tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 for Policing the Planet, a look at the ways police around the world are cooperating to battle international crime. That's Policing the Planet tomorrow afternoon at 3 on WBUR. The weather forecast calling for mostly sunny skies this morning, becoming partly sunny this afternoon, brisk, cold, with highs near 30. Tonight, mostly clear, lows near 20, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, with highs in the mid-30s. In Boston now under clear skies, 21 degrees. It's 23 in Hyannis. 7:39, this is WBUR.
Monday, tune in at noon to WBUR's news magazine, Here and Now. We'll have all the news. Plus, Mexico's foreign minister submits his resignation, citing damaged relations with the U.S. since September 11. And the poetry from hell, why Dante's Inferno still inspires. That's Here and Now, Monday at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the round mound of sound bursts into print. But first, my weekly opportunity to discuss the sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It is divisional playoff weekend in the National Football League. The potentially very dangerous poison, the Atlanta Falcons, about whom you warned us all last week, did emerge victorious in Green Bay. Do you like the Falcons over the Eagles in this week's Battle of the Birds of Prey?
I actually don't. I think the Eagles have played very tough, very smart football all year. This week they get Donovan McNabb, their quarterback, back. And it's an 8 o'clock start in Veterans Stadium, perhaps the worst venue anywhere on the planet for a sports event, large or small. And I don't even want to be on the East Coast if it comes to a point where that crowd realizes that this is the last game ever to be played in Veterans Stadium, because they will take it apart brick by brick and carry it down Broad Street. That is the Lord of the Flies. Whatever the NFL was thinking, putting a playoff game there at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, somebody deserves to be fired.
What about elsewhere on the NFL docket, Charlie?
The Jets and Raiders is an intriguing game, except the two teams have played 350 times in the last 4 years. I don't have any idea at this point how the 49ers will react after all that mishigas in the game against the Giants. I think the Buccaneers will beat them. I think the best game of the bunch outside of the Falcons and Eagles, the Pittsburgh Steelers going down to play Tennessee, because nobody in the league is still yet quite sure how good Tennessee is.
Let's return to last week's flap in the game between the Giants and the 49ers. I gather that because of the way that game ended improperly with the officials missing it, there will be some changes in the way this week's games are officiated.
Look, the NFL has apologized approximately 3 times in its long history. It apologized last week for the however many mistakes were made by the officiating crew on the last play of the Giants 49ers game. The officials on the field will confer in that situation, which means that they will all get together, presumably away from a bunch of incredibly big, sweaty, exhausted men who want to rip off their heads, and come to a calm, cool, reasoned decision, which will be explained to us in an outburst of authentic football gibberish. We will have to see whether or not this makes the individual referees any better at their jobs or not.
In last week's Fiesta Bowl, Charlie, University of Miami running back Willis McGahee went down with a very serious knee injury in the fourth quarter, but his financial, if not his football future, would seem secure. Am I right about this?
Yeah, he managed to get in just under the wire on a $2.5 million insurance policy, which was being put together in the anticipation that McGahee would be in the NFL draft. And the one thing that's very interesting about this is that his value increased through the season as he became more and more prominent in the game, and he was able to get a larger and larger policy. I'm just very happy this happened, because otherwise the whole situation is an enormous argument for people playing not a minute of college football.
Jeff Gordon will host Saturday Night Live tonight. Now, since you are Mr. NASCAR, I assume you will be worked into at least 3 or 4 sketches.
Well, the question is, will Jeff Gordon's messy and public divorce be worked into 3 or 4 sketches? Yet another indication that the sport of the 21st century is mainstreaming itself by leaps and bounds, even as we speak. You know, Jeff Gordon gets to go where Martina Navratilova and Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley and the rest of them have gone before.
The WNBA's Portland Fire was cut loose by its NBA host, the Trailblazers, because, according to Blazers Vice President Aaron Hubert, quote, it's impossible for the team to make money. In an allegedly unrelated development, Charlie, the WNBA said that it was exploring the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut as a potential home for a new franchise. There is money changing hands in casinos.
People are making money somewhere, yeah. as long as there isn't a sports book at the casino, the NBA and the WNBA seem to have no problem with it. The problem is the WNBA is sending out signals that its attachment to its parent organization is becoming a little bit tenuous. And without the NBA trademark, the WNBA doesn't exist. And since it's already swallowed up the other independent women's basketball league, if the NBA were to give up on this project, it's hard to see anybody starting a women's professional basketball league in this country again.
Too late for the holiday season, an interactive sports-related game to be played on wireless devices is on the way. It's Yao Ming basketball. I know you have a cell phone. Is there room on your little instrument there for Yao Ming?
There's always room for Yao Ming. There's room for Yao Ming everywhere.
It's
you
like
know
Jell-O.
I'm sure that this particular product has, you know, nothing to do with the fact that the market in China is like the largest market in the world. I'm sure that didn't enter the calculation at all. I don't think anyone can imagine where the phenomenon that is Mr. Yao is going to be by June.
Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker Joey Porter claims that when his team played the Tennessee Titans back on November 17th, Titans strength and conditioning coach Steve Watterson poured hot coffee on Porter as he went out of bounds. First cut blocking and now this. Where will the outrages end?
I don't know why this is only coming out now. The incident happened November 17th. But apparently one of the coaches' cameras, obviously coaches film the game from dozens and dozens of different angles. Apparently one of the coaches' cameras caught Steve Watterson, the strength and conditioning coach, sort of idly tossing the coffee on the guy and handing the cup to the guy standing next to him, to which all I can say is, whoop, 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 whoop.
Finally, Charlie, male cricket fans in Australia who don't want to go to the concession stands for their own beer because they might miss something on the field are hiring women they're calling beer wenches for their refreshment runs. I wonder if this is a plan likely to catch on elsewhere.
It has caught on elsewhere. If you go to an NBA arena, they have scantily clad waitresses bringing you your beer if you sit down in the lower level seats. Hmm. The fact that this is happening outdoors makes it a little bit different. I do like the fact that the cricket franchises in Sydney went right to the top of the list and hired Sex Bomb Promotions to supply them with their beer wenches. Apparently, the idea is also catching on at motor racing events.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In heaven there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, all our friends will be drinking all our beer.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org.
In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, all our friends will be drinking all our beer.
During his career with the Philadelphia 76ers, Phoenix Suns, and Houston Rockets, Charles Barkley, 11 times an All-Star, exceeded 23,000 points, 12,000 rebounds, and 4,000 assists. But he may be even better known for threatening to run for governor of Alabama and claiming on behalf of Nike that athletes weren't appropriate role models. Charles Barkley has recently collected some of his thoughts in a book entitled I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. He joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Charles Barkley, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
You say of the current NBA, and I'm quoting now, in terms of basketball, the game is not the same. It's entirely money-driven. The owners have always been greedy, but the players have turned into the same people as the owners, and that's amazing to me. How was it different in the good old days?
Well, because I think guys love to play. I think, first of all, the money has become astronomical, so that obviously changed all variables. But you can just tell these guys don't love the game as much as we did when I played. I mean, it's just a totally different mindset. And I think television has had a lot to do with it. It's more like they're out there trying to be fancy than they are just trying to play as hard as they can.
So there's something in the actual play that's different. They don't love the game, and you can tell by watching them?
You can just tell that there's not that life or death situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it's not just basketball. I think if you look at all sports now, it's become strictly business. But I blame players for not letting it become that, because basketball starts out as something you do because you love to do it. And I was very fortunate and able to always keep that mentality. Myself, I look at guys like Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Karl Malone, John Stockton. You can just see the way they played, or we played, that money was not a factor. And I don't get that sense when I watch today's game.
It's interesting, though. In the book, you say that when you first started with Philadelphia, Julius Erving and Moses Malone, guys like that, gave you very good advice about the business side of the game. Hey, you have to take care of yourself here.
Well, I think the biggest thing they did, they taught me the lesson about you make a lot of money, but you don't have to be flashy or showy with it. You know, because when I first went pro, I bought 5 or 6 cars, 7 cars, and And I did it because I don't even know why I did it. It was just stupid. And Dr. J was like terrific. Him and Moses, like, take those cars back. You don't need but one car. He said, first of all, if you put that money in the bank, you'll be able to buy 20 cars in 10, 15 years. But the main thing is you don't have to try to impress people. They know who you are. And it was a very great lesson for me. Now I just drive a truck and that's it. And, you know, I figured out if I pull up in a $100,000 Mercedes or a $50,000 truck, people still know it's me. I don't have to impress other people.
One of the things that fascinated me about the book was your discussion of your college experience. During your discussion of why more college basketball players don't get degrees, you recall when you were at Auburn, somebody said to you the first day at Auburn, they ask, do you want to stay eligible or do you want to graduate? Was that literally true? Did somebody literally ask you that?
Sure, of course that's true. And they're not educating these kids. Even as much, one of the things I wrote in the book, even last year, I think I saw a stat that said 37 out of the 65 teams that went to the NCAA tournament did not graduate a player in the last 5 years, and that's unconscionable.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never graduated players. If you look at the big picture, it's been unfortunate and sad, but college basketball has always been about money and always will be about money. You know, at least in the old days, they faked it like they were trying to get your education. But nowadays, I think we got to start holding these colleges more accountable, making sure these kids get education. Because what they're doing, what they're doing is really unfair. They're making a ton of money on these kids, and they're not graduating them, and that's not right.
Of the circumstances of pro athletes, even very successful pro athletes like Moses Malone and Julius Erving, who advised you when you came into the NBA, you write, quote, in the long run, you're still just a piece of meat to them, them being the team owners. Do you think that's a circumstance peculiar to pro athletes, or is that applicable to workers in general?
That's a great question. I think it is applicable in every situation, but I think sports are different for the simple fact that it's such a small window where you're there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people assume that the average – I was one of the fortunate ones to get to play a long period of time, but the average NBA career is 4 years.
At the end of the book, you say you just want today's players to recognize, quote, how much influence we have and how much impact we can have. What did you have in mind as far as influence and impact are concerned there?
When you're in a position of power, whether you're on the radio, television, or any time you're in the limelight, there's a great deal of power. You have a chance to, number one, inspire kids, network with people to help other people. And it's just a great responsibility. And I don't think they understand what a great responsibility it is. And the problem is now the kids are so young, and you're talking about 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids, and you think about how many people in life want to be judged by something they did when they were 18 or 19 or 20?
Great question.
I mean, nobody does.
It's ever worry you that you're part of the media that's throwing the spotlight on these kids?
It does. I didn't think ESPN should have showed that high school kid. I think that was wrong. I think we in the media, number one, have to be more honest. We don't have to be biased. We're very biased. You know, to me, there's no black and white. There's no Democrat, Republican. There's no rich and poor. Man, we're just all one group of people trying to make this thing work. And until we accept that and learn that, like the system in place in the country now is like, we got to pick and choose what we are. No, we shouldn't have to do that. We should hold the politicians to a high standard to make our lives better, because that's what we elect them to make all our lives better.
Charles, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying, but this sounds a good deal like a campaign speech.
Well, I'm never going to win, and I don't want to win because, number one, they don't pay enough. they don't pay enough. You know, if you think about it, in Alabama this year, they spent about $20 million running for governor for a job that pays $80,000.
Yeah, but the patronage possibilities, think of it, jobs for everybody.
jobs for their friends and handouts to their friends. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, you know, I just look try to look at everything through common sense. And I'm saying to myself, why would somebody spend $20 million trying to get a job that pays $80,000? The only way you could do that if you're going to steal more than the $20 million you spent. I mean, that's just common sense to me. I mean, because there's no person in this country can tell me, why would you spend $20 million for a job that pays $80,000? There's no way they can feasibly work unless you're going to make up the difference by stealing the money.
Charles Barkley, late of the NBA, talks about basketball for TNT these days. He's the author of I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It from Random House. Charles, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Big shots of Mo Cheeks and Moses Malone. Julius Erver called Phileas home. Bobby Jones, Darryl Dawkins, and Tony Tinkin' Freeze. Rocky Balboa will come from South Philly. But if you want to make it on time to the show, there's only one role that you really have to know. So get to Fishtown without all that job. I suggest that you drive on I-95. Want to get downtown but feeling a fix? Get on that road they call 676. The most expensive piece of interstate they ever made. A better than favorite, but they got good game.
Get in on 76ers, Charles Barkley, this Larry Bird.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or learn more about why Charles Barkley doubts he's wrong. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from cardio stripteaser Magly Descends, who responds to the question, did you ever think you were going to be doing stripping as a form of exercise?
Never, ever. Absolutely not. I don't think of it as exercise. I think of it as extracurricular activities.
I'm not touching that. No way. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see here next week. I mean, I'll see you next week. See you next week.
76ers, Charles Barkley, this Larry Bird.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal-treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WB
Public Radio.
This is WB.